From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What a way to run a democracy. It's only June, and the vast majority of candidates for the U.S. Congress have their November elections all locked up. By one count, only 11 out of 435 House races this year are seriously contested, not by accident, but by design. In this hour, we're spelling gerrymander with a capital G, redistricting the 2002 elections, and why running for Congress in America has become a sure thing. We begin in Israel, where a Palestinian gunman killed at least four Israelis in a Jewish settlement late today. Today's attack comes in the wake of suicide bombings this week in Jerusalem and fury in the Israeli government. I spoke with Molly Moore, a reporter for The Washington Post. I asked her what the mood was in Jerusalem after the most recent bombings.
Well, it's much the same as the mood has been for the past several months, although it's always heightened right after you have incidents, especially when you have a back-to-back incident like this. You know, you walk down some of the main streets where there are coffee shops and cafes, and in the last several months, they've been pretty devoid of people, but you would see a few brave souls out. You walk down to these places today, and they're just, completely vacant. After the bus bombing 2 days ago, you see fewer people standing at bus stops. The fear has kind of come home to haunt people once again, because up until this week, there had not been the large rash of these kinds of attacks that you had seen several months ago. So some people were starting a little bit to let down their guards. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's all off now.
The large Israeli incursions of a couple of months ago were presented as a way of stopping these suicide bombings. Since they now clearly haven't, how are Israelis thinking and talking about what they ought to do, pull back or go in harder?
Well, Sharon, in fact, this week has decided that what he should do is not only necessarily go in harder, but once he goes in, to not leave. And this has created a huge controversy even within his own coalition government. His defense minister does not want to reoccupy these territories. But Sharon is saying every time we have one of these terrorist attacks now, we're going to go in and seize some chunk of Palestinian land, and we're not going to leave until all these attacks stop.
What does that mean? We read the Palestinians charge that this is, you know, this is the Israeli game plan all along. They want an excuse to take our land back. We read some in your own piece, quoting from Effie Itam, head of the National Religious Party, saying we're going to take this land and we're going to hold it for a very long time. How does this change the calculus of what's going on?
Well, this is the big question that everyone's waiting to see, of whether it will change it, because many people believed that this was Sharon's intent all along and that now he's just come out and publicly stated it. But other people who were at the security cabinet meeting that decided this two nights ago came out of it very perplexed at the statement that Sharon's office put out, the defense minister being one, saying, wait a minute, I didn't agree to any seizing of any territory for anything more than something very short-term for military operations. So the big question now is, what does it really mean now that Sharon has said this? And we may get some idea in the next few days. Off and on since the big occupations of 2 months ago, they have re-entered some of the towns on the West Bank. In the last 2 days, they've re-entered them yet again. In the town of Jenin, for instance, which your listeners may remember, of where houses were bulldozed 2 months mm-hmm. ago and a large number of people were killed, there was a huge operation there today arresting hundreds of Palestinian men, many of which were then let go. But what was curious is people saw the army bringing in sort of temporary trailers.
As if to stay and live in them.
Exactly. And so people are waiting to see what exactly this means. Now, in the other areas, they went into neighborhoods near the towns of Ramallah and Nablus and Bethlehem, but it was nothing major. It was more curfews in neighborhoods and a few searches and a few arrests. So nobody really knows yet how this is going to shake out.
There seem to be such mixed signals. Early in the week, we were reading about the beginning of construction of a fence or security wall between the West Bank and Israel that implied, people were saying, a kind of a voluntary or unilateral separation. That's just the opposite of sending more troops in.
It is, and the voluntary separation was only voluntary on the part of the Israelis. I mean, the Palestinians had no control over this. Now, what some of the people, the ministers in Sharon's cabinet who are in favor of this more hardline approach of let's take the chunks of land, let's keep them, are saying, wait a minute, the fence is fine, but it's going to take a year to build a fence. What are we going to do between now and then? And this is the rationale that they are using to support going in and holding pieces of land.
We see that 50-plus Palestinian intellectuals have taken out a full-page ad in the Palestinian daily Al-Quds calling for an end to suicide bombings because they said, quote, that the bombings do not achieve progress to achieving our freedom and independence. Is this just the view of some intellectuals in Palestinian society, or is it becoming widely held that a view among Palestinians that the bombings aren't working? How does that sort out?
Well, the Palestinians are very divided because, on the other hand, today, just after this ad ran, the leaders of Hamas came out and said, we're not going to stop the bombings. This is a war, and, you know, this is our technique in the war. Now, Yasser Arafat came out and made a statement similar to one he made several weeks ago, saying that he condemned the attacks and appealed to the would-be suicide bombers and others to please stop the attacks because he said, look, Israel is now just going to use this as an excuse to reoccupy Palestinian territory. So he made an appeal. So there is a large divide. And then among the people who live in the Palestinian territories, there's a large divide, too. I mean, few people like seeing innocent Israelis killed, but they also point out, you know, that innocent Palestinians are killed and that this is a war. And that is the justification on both sides. But what's happening in both the territories and Israel right now, the moderates are becoming more and more hard line because people have just grown weary of the war, weary of the fear and the violence.
In the face of all that, Molly, of course, Washington has leaned back this week. President Bush has delayed making a statement on future White House or U.S. initiatives toward peace. Is there something that Washington can say or do to put this on a better track?
I think what people are waiting for is strong statements of interest from President Bush. One thing you hear time and again here on both sides of the situation is a frustration that the Bush administration took so long to take note of the escalation of the problem out here several months ago. There is a feeling that the U.S. can be a mediator in all of this, and there are a large number that would, you know, like to see the Bush administration step up to the plate in a stronger way and just get involved.
Molly Moore, thank you for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Molly Moore is a reporter with The Washington Post. She spoke with me earlier today from Jerusalem. In this fall's midterm congressional elections, the competition is being eliminated before the voting even begins, often even before the campaign. Thanks to shameless, fine-tuned redistricting, incumbents' chances for re-election have never been better. The loser may be America's political middle ground, as district after district is drawn to be solidly Democratic or solidly Republican. Tonight, the perfectly polarized American political map and its meaning for democracy. Do you want a real contest in your district, a real choice? Have you got one? Odds are you don't. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me from Silver Spring, Maryland, is John Harwood, national political editor with The Wall Street Journal. Good evening and welcome, John Harwood.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
John Harwood, you have written very persuasively about what's going on with the U.S. Congress and races for Congress. Historically, when we get a census, things are shaken up in a way that shakes up Congress. You're saying that this year, it's not shaking things up. As the census flows through to redistricted maps, we're actually seeing the status quo cemented. Why?
Well, we've seen competition in House races declining for years for various reasons, but it's accelerated this time. There are a couple reasons for that. One is that both parties are very evenly divided in the House. They don't want to jeopardize what they have, and so rather than taking risks and drawing new districts and really going after new territory, they said, let's entrench the ones we have and take our chances in the very small number of races that are truly competitive. The other thing is that the computer software, the technology that allows them to match population with vote history and their own party lists, let them fine-tune extremely precisely what the predictable voting patterns of a given district are. So you had in the state of California, for example, where they added one district, there are 53 seats. They sat down and drew up a map that preserved the status quo of 32 Democratic seats, 20 Republican seats. The new seat went to the Democrats, who were ascendant in the state. They entrenched every single one of the incumbents. Gary Condit lost, but of course there were very powerful reasons for that. We've just seen the ability of incumbents, both through their own efforts and through the lines that are drawn, to get reelected at higher and higher rates.
So here we are with a very evenly divided Congress, Republicans with a very narrow advantage. You'd think it would be a national catfight this year, but you're saying that most campaigns will be closer to a cakewalk.
I really think it's a remarkable circumstance. Just 2 years ago, we had an election where the Republican and the Democratic nominees both got 49% of the vote. They split the Electoral College down the middle. One state that was decisive, we had really a margin of several hundred votes out of millions and millions cast. You would think that we would really have a barn burner of a House election. We don't have anything like that. We have, out of the 435 races, something on the order of 390 of them that strategists in both parties think you can just chalk up right now. You know what the outcome is going to be.
It's over already.
That's right. And there are about 44 races that the sort of premier political handicapper in Washington thinks are competitive. And of those, only 11 are races where it's really a 50-50 kind of split. We've got a 50-50 country, but you've got to look long and hard to find House races where that's true.
You quote that political handicapper, Charlie Cook, as saying, in that case, only 11 out of 435 contests are a toss-up. That is, either party could win. And then he looks around and says there's not a single toss-up race in major states like Ohio, Illinois, Michigan, Texas, New Jersey, New York, not even Florida, where, as you point out, it was really the symbol of the nation's 50-50 political split since the 2000 campaign. Not a single toss-up race.
It's amazing. 10 years ago, Charlie did a similar kind of calculation. It was much different. There were 44 toss-up races and 77 races where they were really competitive. So we've seen a sharp decline in competition in just that 10-year period.
It doesn't sound good, but why should we care? What are the consequences of this?
Well, it sort of depends on where you come from on the political spectrum, but what I heard from people in both parties while researching this piece was that the more you stack these districts in favor of one party or the other, what you end up doing is having districts where the action's all in the primary, people are appealing to the party base, and when that happens, when you don't have to cross over and get votes for the other party, Republicans are going hard right, Democrats go hard left, and you really find that the middle of the country, which is a huge swath of the electorate, is not as well represented in Washington. So you have these warring caucuses in the House of Representatives filled with ideologues on both sides. It's very hard to get things done.
Jack Beatty, we want to think of American democracy as a pull and tug of ideas across that middle. John Harwood says the middle's not there because gerrymandering and redistricting has everything sewn up for the status quo, for the polls.
We have an incumbent party. I think we have to recognize that, a party of incumbency that involves both parties.
But not uniform. It's deeply polarized.
Deeply polarized, but they both have the overriding interest. As this piece points out, they actually collude in sort of keeping each other, you know, okay, you won't break up my district and I won't break up yours, and we'll just stay in office as incumbents. And so in a strange way, their self-perpetuation seems to be their dominant motive rather than, say, representing the diversity of the country.
And the health of democracy in the middle of that?
Not good. Not good. I mean, if only 11 races are competitive, are toss-ups, 50-50 now, I mean, what does that say? What about all the people in all those districts who are not of the persuasion of the incumbent? They're never going to get their voices heard. You know, it's looking at this that makes some people say we need proportional representation in America, which is a complicated idea, but basically would be a way of voting that would allow minorities within locked-up districts, such as Republicans in Massachusetts, for example, to have some representation.
We're talking about the permanent incumbent, about redistricting, gerrymandering in the unchallenged U.S. Congress. Do you want a real contest when you go to the polls? have congressional elections been fixed and packaged into a farce, a closed game? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking tonight about redistricting, gerrymandering, and the essentially unchallenged U.S. Congress. Our guest tonight, John Harwood, national political editor at the Wall Street Journal, reports today that only 11 out of 435 elections for Congress this fall are true toss-ups where anybody could win, that redistricting has been used to make districts invulnerable to their Republican or their Democratic incumbents. What do you think? Do you want a real contest when you go to the polls? How has America been carved up into invulnerable Republican and Democratic districts? And are we locking ourselves into two ideologically bound parties with no middle ground? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Adam Schiff. He's Democratic representative from the 27th District in California. Good evening and welcome, Congressman.
Thank you. Pleasure to join you.
Thanks for being with us. You've been spotlighted today in John Harwood's story as an example of someone who has benefited from redistricting. Congressman Schiff, what difference has redistricting made to you as a candidate?
Well, my district, like the vast majority of districts in California, was positively impacted in terms of the changes in redistricting from an incumbent's point of view. And that was true, I think, with every district in California, with the exception of Steve Horn, who was essentially redistricted out of his seat in Congress. So certainly the prevailing policy in the California legislature was to protect incumbents, and that has a number of consequences that flow from it. I don't think that you can conclude that all of the districts in our state are invulnerable. I think some of the suggestions on those lines are a bit overstated. But nonetheless, the trend has been towards incumbency, and that does have the effect, as John points out, that the action is in the primary rather than the general. It tends to make representatives more polarized, more catering to the far left or the far right, and you do lose some representation of the middle. And when you couple that fact with the very close balance in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, where you really need people in the middle that can bridge that partisan divide, it makes it even more challenging.
But there you are, the candidate, as you say, positively impacted by this redistricting. It doesn't look as though candidates like yourselves, are likely to really fight tooth and nail to turn this around. This is working to your advantage. So your advantage and the loss of the middle are all bound together.
Well, it's a little bit like campaign finance reform in that the interest of the office holders is sometimes not the same as the interest of good policy and the political process. Campaign finance reform like McCain-Feingold, I think, was extraordinarily important, and I certainly fought for it. But from a personal incumbency point of view, it's probably not a helpful thing. But at some point, you have to ask yourself what is best for the system and go after that rather than simply look to naked self-interest.
But the fact is it's been going the other way, as John Harwood points out, Congressman Schiff. You sound like a smart guy. How do you reconcile the fact that redistricting has worked for you to help put you in a very advantageous position for your election this fall, but it may not be the best thing for the Congress, for the United States, at a time when we may need a middle to get the country in the right situation?
Well, I think you've recognized a really important issue, and that is what is the effect of redistricting this year? Now, each 10 years, the redistricting impact is different. In the past, it has tended to foster more competitive races. Part of the phenomenon that you're describing, though, was taking place even before the reapportionment. Last year, for example, in the 2000 election cycle, I was one of only four Democrats to defeat Republican incumbents in the nation. I think there were only two Democratic incumbents that lost their seat. That's six seats out of 435 where incumbents were defeated for reelection. Now, it may be this cycle that it is fewer than six or maybe more than six, mm-hmm. but it probably won't be dramatically different. So the trend you're talking about really was taking place before redistricting. Redistricting, I think, will accelerate the trend, but part of what we're seeing is the fact that seats that were held by incumbents who weren't truly representative of their district, that were swept in, for example, in the Revolution of 94, or were Southern Democrats who weren't perceived as representing the conservative values in the South, lost their seats, and tended to be those seats then tend to be represented by people more consistent with the views of their constituency.
So you're saying change can still happen, but it's tougher. John Harwood, give us a very quick tour of what transpired in Congressman Schiff's district. It's a great example of how this is working.
Well, the congressman, of course, knows the details a lot better than I do, but I took a little drive through the district and saw a wealthy area.
Outside L.A.
Called San Marino that voted something on the order of 70% for Congressman Rogan, who Adam Schiff defeated, that was taken out of his district, given to David Dreyer. Dreyer's district had a town called Temple City, which favored Gore in the 2000 election. That went to Congressman Schiff in his new district. So you have little nips and tucks like that that, if you add them all together, have the effect of really shoring up an incumbent of either party, depending on where they are on those boundaries.
In this case, it leaves both the Republican and Democrat Adam Schiff more secure. Adam Schiff, did you or your party representatives sit around in the redistricting conversation and look at the map and say, now, if we just scoot this here and that there, I'll be safe, and so will my Republican neighbor, and won't that be nice?
Well, I can only tell you that in terms of my input in the process was very little, and the map that ultimately emerged looked very much different than any recommendation that I made. My district needed to grow by about 40,000 people because the growth in other parts of the state was faster than in my district. Instead of merely growing by 40,000, I ended up losing 110,000 and gaining 150,000. That's not how I would have done the redistricting in my area if I had been given the pen.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an interesting division of authority over reapportionment. It's the state legislature that not only draws their own lines, but they also draw the lines for the Congress. And I think, actually, one reform in California, although it didn't turn out this way in this reapportionment, may be more effective in future reapportionments at changing some of the calculus, is we have term limits in California. And so you have the people drawing the maps who are going to want to run for seats in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have more of an interest in that than in what the current incumbents favor. And that did have an influence in certain states. I'm not sure how much of an influence it had this year in California. Mm-hmm. But I think we'll see that influence growing in the future.
Tom, there's a fascinating story that on how the two parties work together that came out in a related piece by my colleague Dave Epso, Espo of the AP, which is that before the deal was cut to create these 53 districts in California, the Republican Party chartered a jet to take the Democratic redistricting guru to Washington to meet with Karl Rove, George Bush's top political advisor.
To get the big picture.
They met at the White House, and they signed off on the deal. So you had the sort of the partisan brains on both sides getting together on this.
It's working hand in glove. Congressman Adam Schiff, thank you for joining us. Go and do the right thing.
It was a pleasure.
Thanks. Listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about congressional districts getting more and more secure through redistricting, usually for their incumbent. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, there we hear the congressman. Sounds like a fine guy, but he's taking full advantage of redistricting that makes his Democratic district more secure for him and his neighboring Republican district more secure for his Republican neighbor. It's also cozy.
Yeah, the deal is in. They go to Washington, they cut it from the White House, the Democrats agree, and it's a Republican party. You know, think to yourself, how would his voting be different if he had San Marino? 70% of it went for Bush. If he had that swing vote in his district,
what votes would he cast that would – this inevitably he would cast different votes. And what would happen would be, of course, the votes he would cast would have to show some balance. He couldn't get a 99% from the ADA, much as I would desire him to do. He might have to settle for a 75%. And, you know, look at David Dreyer. If David Dreyer didn't get this other place, maybe he would have to, you know, moderate some of his rip-roaring conservatism and go toward that swing vote. And that's what happened. You take the swing vote out, and these guys just vote their ideology, and they are always appealing to the base so that they're
that is the core, the hardcore base.
The core, and that's where the fundraising is. You know, that's where the money is. Ordinary people don't give money. It's from the groups that are most, you know, the liberal groups and the conservative groups. And
those are the ones that turn out to vote also.
Yes, they don't vote.
They're the ones who turn out to vote. That is, the base turns out. Listeners, what happens to moderation when no one has to appeal to the swing vote, to the middle ground? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Joe's calling from Buffalo, New York. Welcome, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Good to have you.
I have to disagree with your commentators on a couple points. One is that I don't see a rush in ideology to the left or to the right. I see a rush to the middle. And in Buffalo here, our mayor, Mayor Mazziello, was the endorsed candidate of both the Republicans and the Democrats.
That's got to be the middle, doesn't it?
Yeah, it is. But it's middle of the road, and it turned out not to be, you know, that's kind of like standing in the road in terms of Buffalo facing its economic problems because we're not doing too well as a city, and I believe that lack of competition is part of it. But like I say, there's itinerant election people that will work for either campaign, and it seems to me that it's those people that are kind of a hidden force behind this because now, you know, they get to work for the campaigns that are sure to win. You know, they get their paycheck. They don't have to work too hard. You know, as long as the money keeps flowing, everybody's happy.
But locally, Joe, in Buffalo, you're not seeing this polarization. You're seeing a mayor endorsed by both parties. Thanks for that observation. And Jared Harwood, let me put that to you. How does this work out? We're talking about congressional districts here. Joe's saying, wait a minute, at my local level, polarization is not the way it's going. Everything is pinned on one man. How do local and national politics, how do the gears mesh, or do they at all at this level?
I think it's a much different picture. When you're talking about the local level, you're not talking about these abstracted and highly ideological fights that you see in the halls of Congress. You're talking about people dealing with nuts and bolts issues of economic development and traffic and city services. Those don't tend to be ideological fights, and so I don't think it's surprising that you'd see at the local level people appealing to the middle. That's a fundamental difference between the two kinds of politics.
I want to bring Maureen Schwiers into our conversation. Maureen is editor of the House Race Hotline, a publication that follows 200 of the most important congressional races in the country. Good evening, and welcome, Maureen Schwiers.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Maureen Schwiers, aside from California, what states have the most lopsided races where one candidate is strongly predicted to win?
I think the better question actually would be which states do not have the most lopsided races.
I guess that's right.
Overall, we've seen a lot of states trend towards protecting their incumbents. The only states that really went out of the way to create competitive districts that are competitive are Pennsylvania. Republicans created a map that made a number of Democrats vulnerable. Democrats countered by creating a competitive map in Georgia, and then less competitive on a scale maps, but still have heavily contested districts are in Maryland and Michigan. So you have, you know, 50 states, and just four have incredibly competitive redistricting maps. However, a great example is in Iowa. They have an independent redistricting commission that draws the maps. And four out of the five seats in that state are competitive, which is more than California, Texas, and Illinois combined. So it's more so states that don't have safe maps drawn.
What's changed about the way redistricting is done, Maureen Schwiers? What has brought us to this point?
a lot of it is technology completely.
Technology? We thought technology it was smoke-filled rooms. How does technology come in?
Smoke-filled rooms. Redistricting isn't a process that the public pays much attention to because it happens every 10 years. It's filled with legalese, and it's not an issue that affects people in their daily lives when redistricting is going on.
But how does technology come in? You're talking about computer programs that help them sort out precisely where to draw the line to ensure a victory?
Right now, any political group, any incumbent can buy computer programs that can draw their own maps. And in a lot of places, we've seen incumbents who have bought this software, hired lobbyists to go to the state legislatures, and they've shown up in hand with maps that of the district that they want. And the state legislature level, a lot of people want to, you know, get along with their, you know, congressional members. In some cases, we've had, you know, entire delegations where it drew a bipartisan map that they all agreed on. And it's much easier to pass the, you know, a map that's already drawn than to go through the process yourself in the state legislature.
Jack Beatty, can you imagine computers spitting out 1,000 ways to fine-tune the political map just the way you want it, sort of 50 ways to leave your lover or to stay in Congress? Any way you like it, the computers will cut it for you.
They sure will. And I've read about some of these programs. They can really get down to fine detail, can't they, Maureen?
Oh, it goes down to the block, basically. And usually it was just, you know, tons of crates were delivered, you know, of paperwork and things like that from the Census Bureau. Now it can all be downloaded on a CD, and anyone can draw a map.
Tom Davis, the Republican who heads the House Campaign Committee in Congress, said the other day, it used to be that voters picked the candidates, now the candidates pick the voters.
Yes.
that's what you call a complete turnaround. Maureen Schwierz, when you talk with candidates, are they at all abashed about this, or are they, happy as a pig in politics, let's say?
Well, the candidates that we talk to are in competitive races. So, you know, we watch the most competitive races, and the number has shrunk down. So I think more so it's the potential candidates, the candidates who had been planning to run for so long and can't because of a non-competitive map, that are disappointed. A good example is in Oklahoma, where Oklahoma was losing one seat in redistricting, and it presented a great opportunity for them for Democrats to pick up a district. However, the Governor Keating and the Republican incumbents all got together, drew a map that protected them, and that happened to be the map that was picked in the court. So there were three candidates who had raised, you know, over $100,000, you know, to get ready for this race that didn't exist.
And there it goes. Maureen Schwierz, you're the pro. Real quickly, we're coming up on a break, but there's only 6 seats that Democrats need to regain a House majority. Can they do it?
It looks like a very difficult uphill climb. Redistricting was even for both parties, and also after September 11th, the traditional president's party of the president loses seats, it kind of all decimated. So it's going to be one district by district. And right now it's very difficult. When you only have 40 competitive seats across the nation, that number will likely go down. Getting to 6 is a pretty large percentage.
Sounds like it's not going to happen. Maureen Schwierz, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Maureen Schwierz is editor of the House Race Hotline, a publication that follows 200 of the most important congressional races in the country. We're talking about redistricting, gerrymandering, and the unchallenged U.S. Congress. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the permanent polarized incumbency, redistricting, gerrymandering, and the unchallenged U.S. Congress. Our guest tonight, John Harwood, national political editor at the Wall Street Journal, says that redistricting has been used to cement hundreds of congressional seats, lines redrawn so that Democrats are safe, Republicans are safe, everybody's safe. Only 6 seats will make a difference in whether or not a new party comes to the majority in the House this year, and it's unlikely to change. Think of 1894, when there was a 120-seat Republican gain in the Congress. Think of 1994, when Republicans picked up 52 seats in one election. This year, it's not happening. Redistricting is a big part of the reason why. The fix is almost in. The question is, do you want a real contest when you go to the polls? And when only a handful of congressmen face real challenges anymore, what does it mean for American democracy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, David. You're on the air.
Well, thank you for my call.
Sure.
I don't think there's a whole lot of news here, actually. I think the incumbency rate, clearly by party, if not by individual district, has been steady for a long time. You mentioned 1894 was a big swing, and 1994 was a big swing, and I think it was a big swing for the Democrats in 1952 or something. And after those big swings, things stay pretty much the same for a long time.
So you see steady as she goes, but is it possible, David, that within that there is something different, that though it didn't change, as Jack Beatty said earlier, politicians did have swing votes that they had to negotiate within their districts, and therefore they might not have, even though the numbers may not have changed every election, that there was more horse trading over that center, which is now lost?
There may have been. I think it's awfully hard to make that argument, though, because if you look at especially the Democratic majorities from, like I say, 52 to 94, there wasn't a need to appeal to swing voters. I mean, they had such a massive majority.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans were the same way in the 20s. So I don't know that's really a case. Your guest there, Mr. Harwood, also brought up proportional representation.
Or maybe Jack Beatty did, yes.
Yeah, okay. I think that's a really bad idea. I think that fractures the electorate more. It fractures the party system more. And if we had three or four parties, that might be okay. But if we had 60 or 70, we end up with a coalition-style government.
David, you're watching closely. You're watching closely, and we like that. Let us pick up both of those, and thank you for your call. John Harwood first. David challenges the premise here. He said, hey, this is same old, same old. We've never seen radical, frequent changes in the makeup of the Congress. Make the case. What's the qualitative difference that you're pointing to here?
Well, there's a short-term issue and a long-term issue. Over the long term, incumbent reelection rates have in fact been rising. If you look at the number of partisan turnover coming out of the elections since World War II, for example, the first 14 elections after World War II, you had an average gain or loss for the two parties of 27 seats per election. The last 14, it's been 16 seats. Same thing is true of the proportion of incumbents reelected with large majorities. That's been going up over time. What's unique about this cycle is that long-term trend is mm-hmm. continuing. Incumbent reelection rates remain in the upper 90s. But in addition to that, you have two evenly divided parties who have set out really not to do anything about it. They because they are so close and they're so reluctant to risk anything that they now have. You see, because if you go for a new seat in redistricting, that means by definition you're going to weaken your prospects in adjacent districts.
That's right.
And
so things go up for grabs, and as an alternative, they go for a ceasefire.
Exactly.
Jack Beatty, our caller, Dave, also raises this issue of proportional representation. Give us just the thumbnail sketch of how that would work.
Well, gosh, I mean, he does raise the specter of multiple parties, and that is frightening, but I don't know that we'd ever get there. The basic argument for it is that
tell us what it is.
Oh, well, it would allow for an extra, you'd have your regular congressperson, and then you might have, depending upon the proportion of votes, another member. Sort of, you have to increase the membership of the House, but that other member would be able to represent the 49.9% or 8% who are on the other side. We have a first past the post system where if you win by one vote, you represent all those other voters who the 99% that are the 49% on the other side. They have no representation.
Mm.
PR is a way of breaking that up. It's a complicated system. It's used in some localities. Lanny Guinier got into trouble for, I think, advocating a very brilliant example of this and was thought to be undemocratic. In fact, it's very democratic.
But
it's
not really
democratic.
But not really much on the agenda. Let's get one more call. Terry's on the line. Welcome, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I was the finance director for a challenging race 10 years ago in upstate New York against Congressman John LaFalce, who has now sat in his seat for 28 years.
How did it look as the representing the challenger there, Terry?
Well, it was interesting because to this day, no other race in the 28 years he's been in Congress has come as close. Of course, it was 1994, and there was a huge swing. In any event, we raised, out-fundraised him on a 2-to-1 margin without taking PAC money. We were for campaign finance reform, flat tax.
Did you see redistricting working against you?
I don't, at that point, it did not because the seat hadn't been redistricted. But I find it interesting that in all of the ensuing years, I live in Boston now, but he's still there because of the gerrymandering that you're talking about.
It keeps him well ensconced. Terry, thanks for your call. John Harwood, is there anything on the horizon in the 40 seconds we have left that's going to break up this trend? We've got computers getting it down to a science. We've got the two parties agreeing to share the spoils. How do we break through this to find the middle ground, or for that matter, to find a third voice that we may not hear now?
Well, typically, you know, politics gets realigned when you have a galvanizing national event, a war, an economic crisis.
We've got both. What does it take?
Well, this is a war where there isn't too much disagreement at the moment. And in terms of the economy is in recovery. I talked to one expert on congressional politics who said, well, maybe a depression would bust up this system. Short of that, I think you're going to see a demographic drift playing a role. You know, there's the movement, increased influx of Hispanics to this country could shake up some of these districts, even though the boundary lines wouldn't suggest competition.
We're going to have to keep our eye out for demographic drift. And thank you for joining us tonight, John Harwood.
Thanks for having me.
John Harwood is national political editor at The Wall Street Journal. And Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. In a moment, reconsidering America's chances in the World Cup. This is On Point. Two weeks ago tonight, on this very program, we brought in soccer experts to preview the World Cup competition in Japan and Korea. Their unanimous and incorrect consensus, don't expect too much from the U.S. soccer team. After finishing dead last in the field of 32 at the 1998 World Cup, nobody, including us, saw the Americans making waves this year. Boy, were we wrong. To the surprise of Portugal and Mexico and the delight of On Point, the U.S. team has made it all the way to the quarterfinals, where it will face mighty Germany tomorrow. ESPN soccer commentator Seamus Mallon was one of the skeptics who saw slim prospects for the American team on our show 2 weeks ago. Earlier, I sat down with him to eat a happy meal of crow. Seamus Mallon, you have been following these games closely, have you not?
Absolutely.
And you recall our conversation of 2 weeks ago when we and the rest of the world looked back at 98 when the United States finished dead last, number 32, and wondered how on earth it would go forward. You recall that?
I sure do.
Okay. Let's listen to a clip of you and a little bit of me then, and then we'll look at the miracle that's transpired since.
It's very difficult to see where the United States is going to pick up the points because the odds are that they will not beat Portugal, which is a very highly favored side to finally produce an excellent result. Poland is a side that on a day can be terrific or can be awful, so it depends on how they show up. And as Derek said, the South Korean are the host side. So in many ways, we are back into the same kind of forbidding opposition that we did so poorly against in 98.
Seamus Mallon, there it was on the eve of the World Cup opening just a little more than 2 weeks ago, and it was looking forbidding. What hath U.S. soccer wrought here?
Well, you know, I think I, along with 1,000 other prognosticators, have to hold our hands up and say, you know, we got it wrong. I thought the best of circumstances, the U.S. might get 4 points. I thought the points would come from South Korea, a tie, which they got, and a win over Poland, which they didn't get. To everybody's amazement, they beat Portugal, and to everybody's further amazement, 4 points was enough to send them through. So this is the kind of story, however, that is a mere microcosm of the World Cup story to begin with in the first place. Argentina's gone. France is gone. Mm-hmm. Italy's gone. Portugal's gone. All the teams that everybody thought would be up in there for a fight. This has been a World Cup that has been turned totally on its head, and it's absolutely wonderful.
Does it already qualify as a miracle in terms of the U.S. performance?
Miracles. I don't know quite how you define a miracle. In the Al Michaels vernacular, maybe it is a miracle. But
we don't mean heavenly intervention, but no. But so far beyond expectation, yeah, that everyone's jaw is on the floor.
Well, I think it's so far beyond expectations for a whole bunch of reasons. But I think the thing that we really got to take out of this, and what is the lesson? The lesson is that this team played and is playing with more sort of international maturity and savvy than perhaps we had given them credit for. And combining that with some shockingly bad performance by Portugal, who really did not respect the United States one whit, has contrived and conspired to get them into the match against Mexico. Now, having said that, once they got to Mexico, let me tell you, I was absolutely cocksure again that they would easily beat Mexico. We know how to beat Mexico. The U.S. can do it and did it in grand style.
Mm-hmm. Is it a fluke, or has something changed in U.S. soccer and its standing vis-a-vis the rest of the world's teams?
Well, it's interesting. If you read the British press, which is totally unforgiving vis-a-vis American soccer, never gives any credit whatsoever for what America accomplishes. They say it's total luck and lousy performances by the opponents. I think that's just sort of cultural bias, quite frankly. Yes, there were a break here or two for the United States, for sure. But there is very definitely a shift here, because the young players have come through in a way that they have never come through before. In 1998, everybody said, oh, American soccer has been set back. I didn't buy that at all. In fact, what's happened is that the next young generation of players since 98 has, in fact, shown more playing maturity and more willingness and hunger and confidence in the big stage than we ever could have believed possible 4 years ago.
And is there a U.S. style, a new U.S. style that's emerged? You talk about international maturity. How does that translate into victories?
Well, I think the style is one of saying, okay, who are we playing today? Fine, we don't fear them. They don't fear anybody. Say, now, how can we beat them? Not how can we prevent losing to them. That's the kind of sea change in mental attitude. Where do we go to beat them? Not how do we stop losing. So I think you have to attribute it to the very positive preparation of the coach, his player management skills, and the attitude of the players and the determination to prove that they are now players who can play on the world stage, and they're right.
Next up, Germany. They've won the World Cup 4 times. John Powers of the Boston Globe says the Germans have to beat the Americaners or apply for asylum in Pyongyang. How do you read the odds?
Well, just a quick correction. They've won it 3 times. The Brazilians have won it 4 times.
My mistake.
But they've been in semifinals 3 other times. They've been in third. I mean, they are just a fabulous pedigree. Now, having said that, while they do get some players back, but they did not have their last game because of suspensions and injuries, this is not the best German team ever, by any means, to compete. But they are Germans in the last 8, and they are unbelievably competitive. And as John Powers puts it so tellingly, the thought of losing to the Americans in this sport is unthinkable. It's like having a McDonald's planted in your front garden. That's what it means.
Win or lose, the Americans have pulled off something extraordinary here. We're eating crow together tonight, Seamus Mallett, and it tastes delicious.
Yeah, absolutely. Best I've ever had.
Thanks for being with us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Seamus Mallon is a soccer commentator for ESPN. The U.S. soccer team kicks off against Germany in the World Cup quarterfinals at 7:30 a.m. Eastern Time tomorrow. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.